Members of the Congress, I have the high privilege and distinct honor of presenting to you the President of the United States.
All right. Thank you. Thank you very much. Mr. Speaker, Mr. President, distinguished members of the Congress, honored guests and fellow citizens, thank you for allowing me to delay my address until this evening. We pause together to mourn and honor the valor of our seven Challenger heroes. And I hope that we're now ready to do what they would want us to do. Go forward, America, and reach for the stars. We will never forget those brave seven, but we shall go forward. Mr. Speaker, before I begin my prepared remarks, may I point out that tonight marks the 10th and last State of the Union message that you've presided over. And on behalf of the American people, I want to salute you for your service to Congress and country. I have come to review with you the progress of our nation, to speak of unfinished work, and to set our sights on the future. I am pleased to report the state of our union is stronger than a year ago and growing stronger each day. Tonight we look out on a rising America, firm of heart, united in spirit, powerful in pride and patriotism. America is on the move. But it wasn't long ago that we looked out on a different land. Locked factory gates, long gasoline lines, intolerable prices, and interest rates turning the greatest country on earth into a land of broken dreams. Government growing beyond our consent had become a lumbering giant, slamming shut the gates of opportunity, threatening to crush the very roots of our freedom. What brought America back? The American people brought us back with quiet courage and common sense. With undying faith that in this nation under God, the future will be ours, for the future belongs to the free. Tonight, the American people deserve our thanks for 37 straight months of economic growth, for sunrise firms and modernized industries creating 9 million new jobs in 3 years, interest rates cut in half, inflation falling over from 12% in 1980 to under 4% today, and a mighty river of good works, a record $74 billion in voluntary giving just last year alone. And despite the pressures of our modern world, family and community remain the moral core of our society, guardians of our values and hopes for the future. Family and community are the co-stars of this great American comeback. They are why we say tonight, private values must be at the heart of public policies. What is true for families in America is true for America in the family of free nations. History is no captive of some inevitable force. History is made by men and women of vision and courage. Tonight, freedom is on the march. The United States is the economic miracle, the model to which the world once again turns. We stand for an idea whose time is now. Only by lifting the weights from the shoulders of all can people truly prosper, and can peace among all nations be secure. Teddy Roosevelt said that a nation that does great work lives forever. We have done well, but we cannot stop at the foothills when Everest beckons. It's time for America to be all that we can be. We speak tonight of an agenda for the future, an agenda for a safer, more secure world. And we speak about the necessity for actions to steel us for the challenges of growth, trade, and security in the next decade and the year 2000. And we will do it not by breaking faith with bedrock principles, but by breaking free from failed policies. Let us begin where storm clouds loom darkest, right here in Washington, D.C. This week, I will send you our detailed proposals. Tonight, let us speak of our responsibility to redefine government's role. Not to control, not to demand or command, not to contain us, but to help in times of need, and above all, to create a ladder of opportunity to full employment so that all Americans can climb toward economic power and justice on their own. But we cannot win the race to the future shackled to a system that can't even pass a federal budget. We cannot win that race held back by horse and buggy programs that waste tax dollars and squander human potential. We cannot win that race if we're swamped in a sea of red ink. Now, Mr. Speaker, you know, I know, and the American people know, the federal budget system is broken. It doesn't work. Before we leave this city, let you and I work together to fix it. Then we can finally give the American people a balanced budget. Members of Congress, passage of Graham Rudman Hollings gives us an historic opportunity to achieve what has eluded our national leadership for decades, forcing the federal government to live within its means. Your schedule now requires that the budget resolution be passed by April 15th, the very day America's families have to foot the bill for the budgets that you produce. How often we read of a husband and wife, both working, struggling from paycheck to paycheck to raise a family, meet a mortgage, pay their taxes and bills. And yet some in Congress say taxes must be raised. Well, I'm sorry. They're asking the wrong people to tighten their belts. It's time we reduced the federal budget and left the family budget alone. We do not face large deficits because American families are undertaxed. We face those deficits because the federal government overspends. The detailed budget that we will submit will meet the Graham Rudman Hollings target for deficit reductions, meet our commitment to ensure a strong national defense, meet our commitment to protect Social Security and the truly less fortunate, and yes, meet our commitment to not raise taxes. How should we accomplish this? Well, not by taking from those in need. As families take care of their own, government must provide shelter and nourishment for those who cannot provide for themselves. But we must revise or replace programs enacted in the name of compassion, that degrade the moral worth of work, encourage family breakups, and drive entire communities into a bleak and heartless dependency. Graham Rudman Hollings can mark a dramatic improvement, but experience shows that simply setting deficit targets does not assure they'll be met. We must proceed with Grace Commission reforms against waste, and tonight I ask you to give me what 43 governors already have. Give me a line item veto this year. Give me the authority to veto waste, and I'll take the responsibility. I'll make the cuts. I'll take the heat. This authority would not give me any monopoly power, but simply prevent spending measures from sneaking through that could not pass on their own merit. And you can sustain or override my veto. That's the way the system should work. Once we've made the hard choices, we should lock in our gains with a balanced budget amendment to the Constitution. I mentioned that we will meet our commitment to national defense. We must meet it. Defense is not just another budget expense. Keeping America strong, free, and at peace is solely the responsibility of the federal government. It is government's prime responsibility. We have devoted 5 years trying to narrow a dangerous gap born of illusion and neglect, and we've made important gains. Yet the threat from Soviet forces, conventional and strategic, from the Soviet drive for domination, from the increase in espionage and state terror, remains great. This is reality. Closing our eyes will not make reality disappear. We pledged together to hold real growth in defense spending to the bare minimum. My budget honors that pledge, and I'm now asking you, the Congress, to keep its end of the bargain. The Soviets must know that if America reduces her defenses, it will be because of a reduced threat, not a reduced resolve. Keeping America strong is as vital to the national security as controlling federal spending is to our economic security. But as I've said before, the most powerful force we can enlist against the federal deficit is an ever-expanding American economy, unfettered and free. The magic of opportunity, unreserved, unfailing, unrestrained. Isn't this the calling that unites us? I believe our tax rate cuts for the people have done more to spur a spirit of risk-taking and help America's economy break free than any program since John Kennedy's tax cut almost a quarter century ago. Now, history calls us to press on, to complete efforts for an historic tax reform, providing new opportunity for all and ensuring that all pay their fair share. But no more. We've come this far. Will you join me now, and we'll walk this last mile together? You know my views on this. We cannot and we will not accept tax reform that is a tax increase in disguise. True reform must be an engine of productivity and growth, and that means a top personal rate no higher than 35%. True reform must be truly fair, and that means raising wages to $2,000. True reform means a tax system that at long last is pro-family, pro-jobs, pro-future, and pro-America. As we knock down the barriers to growth, we must redouble our efforts for freer and fairer trade. We have already taken actions to counter unfair trading practices and to pry open closed foreign markets. We will continue to do so. We will also oppose legislation touted as providing protection that in reality pits one American worker against another, one industry against another, one community against another, and that raises prices for us all. If the United States can trade with other nations on a level playing field, we can outproduce, outcompete, and outsell anybody anywhere in the world. The constant expansion of our economy and exports requires a sound and stable dollar at home and reliable exchange rates around the world. We must never again permit wild currency swings to cripple our farmers and other exporters. Farmers in particular have suffered from past unwise government policies. They must not be abandoned with problems they did not create and cannot control. We've begun coordinating economic and monetary policy among our major trading partners, but there's more to do. And tonight, I am directing Treasury Secretary Jim Baker to determine if the nations of the world should convene to discuss the role and relationship of our currencies. Confident in our future, secure in our values, Americans are striding forward to embrace the future. We see it not only in our recovery, but in three straight years of falling crime rates, as families and communities band together to fight pornography, drugs, and lawlessness, and to give back to their children the safe and, yes, innocent childhood they deserve. We see it in the renaissance in education, the rising SAT scores for 3 years. Last year's increase, the greatest since 1963. It wasn't government and Washington lobbies that turned education around. It was the American people who, in reaching for excellence, knew to reach back to basics. We must continue the advance by supporting discipline in our schools, vouchers that give parents freedom of choice, and we must give back to our children their lost right to acknowledge God in their classrooms. We are a nation of idealists. Yet today there is a wound in our national conscience. America will never be whole as long as the right to life granted by our Creator is denied to the unborn. For the rest of my time, I shall do what I can to see that this wound is one day healed. As we work to make the American dream real for all, we must also look to the condition of America's families. Struggling parents today worry how they will provide their children the advantages that their parents gave them. In the welfare culture, the breakdown of the family, the most basic support system, has reached crisis proportions. In female and child poverty, child abandonment, horrible crimes, and deteriorating schools. After hundreds of billions of dollars in poverty programs, the plight of the poor grows more painful. But the waste in dollars and cents pales before the most tragic loss, the sinful waste of human spirit and potential. We can ignore this terrible truth no longer. As Franklin Roosevelt warned 51 years ago, standing before this chamber, he said, "Welfare is a narcotic, a subtle destroyer of the human spirit." And we must now escape the spider's web of dependency. Tonight, I am charging the White House Domestic Council to present me by December 1, 1986, an evaluation of programs and a strategy for immediate action to meet the financial, educational, social, and safety concerns of poor families. I'm talking about real and lasting emancipation, because the success of welfare should be judged by how many of its recipients become independent of welfare. Further, after seeing how devastating illness can destroy the financial security of a family, I'm directing the Secretary of Health and Human Services, Dr. Otis Bowen, to report to me by year-end with recommendations on how the private sector and government can work together to address the problems of affordable insurance for those whose life savings would otherwise be threatened when catastrophic illness strikes. And tonight, I want to speak directly to America's younger generation, because you hold the destiny of our nation in your hands. With all the temptations young people face, it sometimes seems the allure of the permissive society requires superhuman feats of self-control. But the call of the future is too strong, a challenge too great to get lost in the blind alleyways of despair. Never has there been a more exciting time to be alive, a time of rousing wonder and heroic achievement. As they said in the film, Back to the Future, where we're going, we don't need roads. Well, today, physicists peering into the infinitely small realms of subatomic particles find reaffirmations of religious faith. Astronomers build a space telescope that can see to the edge of the universe and possibly back to the moment of creation. So yes, this nation remains fully committed to America's space program. We're going forward with our shuttle flights. We're going forward to build our space station. And we're going forward with research on a new Orient Express that could, by the end of the next decade, take off from Dulles Airport, accelerate up to 25 times the speed of sound, attaining low Earth orbit, or flying to Tokyo within 2 hours. The same technology transforming our lives can solve the greatest problem of the 20th century. A security shield can one day render nuclear weapons obsolete and free mankind from the prison of nuclear terror. America met one historic challenge and went to the moon. Now America must meet another. To make our strategic defense real for all the citizens of planet Earth. Let us speak of our deepest longing for the future, to leave our children a land that is free and just in a world at peace. It's my hope that our fireside summit in Geneva, Mr. Gorbachev's upcoming visit to America, can lead to a more stable relationship. Surely, no people on Earth hate war or love peace more than we Americans. But we cannot stroll into the future with childlike faith. Our differences with a system that openly proclaims and practices an alleged right to command people's lives and to export its ideology by force are deep and abiding. Logic and history compel us to accept that our relationship be guided by realism, rock hard, clear-eyed, steady, and sure. Our negotiators in Geneva have proposed a radical cut in offensive forces by each side with no cheating. They have made clear that Soviet compliance with the letter and spirit of agreements is essential. If the Soviet government wants an agreement that truly reduces nuclear arms, there will be such an agreement. But arms control is no substitute for peace. We know that peace follows in freedom's path, and conflicts erupt when the will of the people is denied. So we must prepare for peace, not only by reducing weapons, but by bolstering prosperity, liberty, and democracy, however and wherever we can. We advance the promise of opportunity every time we speak out on behalf of lower tax rates, freer markets, sound currencies around the world. We strengthen the family of freedom every time we work with allies and come to the aid of friends under siege. And we can enlarge the family of free nations if we will defend the unalienable rights of all God's children to follow their dreams. To those imprisoned in regimes held captive, to those beaten for daring to fight for freedom and democracy, for their right to worship, to speak, to live, and to prosper in the family of free nations. We say to you tonight, you are not alone, freedom fighters. America will support you with moral and material assistance. Your right not just to fight and die for freedom, but to fight and win freedom. To win freedom in Afghanistan, in Angola, in Cambodia, and in Nicaragua. This is a great moral challenge for the entire free world. Surely no issue is more important for peace in our own hemisphere, for the security of our frontiers, for the protection of our vital interests, than to achieve democracy in Nicaragua and to protect Nicaragua's democratic neighbors. Now, this year, I will be asking Congress for the means to do what must be done for the great and good cause. As Scoop Jackson, the inspiration for our bipartisan Commission on Central America, once said, in matters of national security, the best politics is no politics. What we accomplish this year in each challenge we face will set our course for the balance of the decade. Indeed, for the remainder of the century. After all we've done so far, let no one say that this nation cannot reach the destiny of our dreams. America believes America is ready. America can win the race to the future, and we shall. The American dream is a song of hope that rings through night, winter air, vivid, tender music that warms our hearts when the least among us aspire to the greatest things, to venture a daring enterprise, to unearth new beauty in music, literature, and art, to discover a new universe inside a tiny silicon chip or a single human cell. We see the dream coming true in the spirit of discovery of Richard Cavoli. All his life, he's been enthralled by the mysteries of medicine. And Richard, we know that the experiment that you began in high school was launched and lost last week. Yet your dream lives, and as long as it's real, work of noble note will yet be done. Work that could reduce the harmful effects of X-rays on patients and enable astronomers to view the golden gateways of the farthest stars. We see the dream glow in the towering talent of a 12-year-old Tyrone Ford, a child prodigy of gospel music. He has surmounted personal adversity to become an accomplished pianist and singer. He also directs the choirs of three churches and has performed at the Kennedy Center. With God as your composer, Tyrone, your music will be the music of angels. We see the dream being saved by the courage of a 13-year-old Shelby Butler, honor student and member of her school's safety patrol. Seeing another girl freeze in terror before an out-of-control school bus, she risked her life and pulled her to safety. With bravery like you or Shelby, America need never fear for our future. And we see the dream born again of the joyful compassion of a 13-year-old Trevor Farrell. 2 years ago, age 11, watching men and women bedding down in abandoned doorways on television, he was watching. Trevor left his suburban Philadelphia home to bring blankets and food to the helpless and homeless. And now, 250 people help him fulfill his nightly vigil. Trevor's, yours is the living spirit of brotherly love. Would you four stand up for a moment? Thank you. Thank you. You are heroes of our hearts. We look at you and know it's true. In this land of dreams fulfilled, where greater dreams may be imagined, nothing is impossible. No victory is beyond our reach. No glory will ever be too great. So now, it's up to us, all of us, to prepare America for that day when our work will pale before the greatness of America's champions in the 21st century. The world's hopes rest with America's future. America's hopes rest with us. So let us go forward to create our world of tomorrow in faith, in unity, and in love. God bless you, and God bless America.
With a wink toward the balcony where Mrs. Reagan watched and his State of the Union address, and with a handshake for Vice President Bush and retiring House Speaker Tip O'Neill, President Reagan ends his fifth State of the Union address from the capital of the United States. Now, in case you joined us late or were distracted for some reason, recapping very briefly some of the highlights of President Reagan's address tonight as he makes his way out. The president picked up right where he left off last year, picking up his theme of America is back. Tonight he said, and I quote, "We look out on a rising America. America," President Reagan said, "is on the move." As had been indicated, there were a few specifics in this State of the Union address. And interestingly enough, one of the few outright pitches President Reagan made tonight for specific legislation is one that he's made before and is one that he's considered to be least likely to get. The president asked again for the so-called line item veto. This would be an increase in presidential power vis-a-vis the Congress. The president asked for the power to kill only the parts of bills that he doesn't like instead of having to veto a whole bill, as is now the case. The president asked for a study on how best to provide for catastrophic illness insurance for the elderly. Long hospital stays that are relatively rare but not covered by Medicare and that can wipe out a family's finances. This is widely expected to be possibly one of the fulcrum issues for this year's congressional election. The president called for a study on the issue, but not, he didn't call for the plan outright that his own Health and Human Services Secretary, Dr. Otis Bowen, is known to favor. Dr. Bowen has said that a modest monthly rise in Medicare insurance rates spread over millions of Medicare recipients could cover the catastrophic illness costs of the relatively few who would need it. The president did not come out and say he backed that. He called for a study on that issue. The president spent a good deal of time the address dwelling on what he called family values. Again, this is widely expected to be made an issue in this year's congressional elections by both parties. The president talked about family budgets and said there would be no new taxes. That, in quick summary form, was what the president's State of the Union address was centered upon. Besides paying tribute to the seven fallen Challenger astronauts, the president made mention of several space programs. Besides going forward with shuttle missions, the president put in a plug for his space-based Star Wars defense and also for a separate program to build a new space plane, a kind of very far advanced Concorde, a plane that would travel some 25 times the speed of sound. The president didn't mention the price tag. The Pentagon has pegged it at about $2 billion for one of those space planes. And the president, what he said was a departure from his script tonight, paid tribute to the soon-to-depart member of Congress, one of his chief adversaries on the Hill, House Speaker Tip O'Neill. House Speaker O'Neill plans to retire from Congress when his current term is up. Now, there are, of course, other views of the State of the Union, views tonight other than those just expressed by President Reagan. And in a moment, we'll have the State of the Union as seen and presented by the Democrats. So stay with us. Hello again, and a reminder that our regularly scheduled program will start on the hour. You may say, well, the President's State of the Union address is already over. Why aren't you going back to the regularly scheduled program right now? It will start on the hour. But we have a long-standing CBS News policy. It's a policy that CBS News pioneered of presenting alternative and opposing views on matters of public importance and controversy. And certainly a view on the State of the Union is such an occasion. So in keeping with that CBS News policy, we're about to provide an opportunity for the Democrats to give their views of the State of the Union. Now, these views are produced under the auspices of the Democratic leadership of the House and Senate. And the production for this is paid for by the Democratic National Committee, the Democratic Senate Campaign Committee, and the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee. Now, among those that you'll be hearing speak tonight will be Representative Thomas Daschle of South Dakota, former Virginia Governor Charles Chuck Robb, former Lieutenant Governor Harriet Woods of Missouri, among others. One reason for doing this is one reason the policy was pioneered, whether you have a Republican president or a Democratic president, particularly in campaign years, everybody worries about one party or the other getting an advantage. So that's one reason this kind of policy was set. Now, the first speaker for the Democrats is to be former Judge Senator George Mitchell of Maine.
14 years from now, in this chamber, another American president will deliver the first State of the Union address of the 21st century. On that day, Americans will still be exploring, following the brave tradition of the seven Challenger astronauts, of whom the president spoke so eloquently tonight. In times of national tragedy, the president speaks for every American. This week, President Reagan has done so with special grace, and we salute him for it. We mourn the loss of the astronauts, and from it we take new resolve to finish their voyage, to continue to reach for the stars. That spirit of great endeavor has always guided our country and those who serve it. As we look to the 21st century, we know that how well Americans are doing then depends on what we do now. Today, the values we share, the things we care about most, are being tested in new ways, in a new time. The issue is not the outcome of old debates or of the last election. History won't wait for us to quarrel about the past. We're already engaged as a country, as a people, in a contest for the future. That future is as promising as the 10-year-olds who've mastered a computer that we, their parents, don't quite understand. It is as powerful as the moral claim of people in South Africa, in Afghanistan, people around the world who simply want to live in freedom and who want to know, is America on their side? It is as urgent as the toxic waste which too often poisons the yards where our children play. But when you think about it, the real State of the Union is not found in a speech, any speech, or here in the nation's capital. The State of the Union is found where we all live, in our homes, with our families, on farms and cities and towns all across America, where the State of our Union has been found for 200 years.
Thomas Jefferson was a remarkable man, an inventor, a visionary, author of the Declaration of Independence, and a founder of the Democratic Party. He saw America as a bold experiment in human freedom, and he knew that each generation would have to face new realities and chart its own course. That's where we are tonight. Now it's our turn to make the tough choices, to tackle the changes we face. If anyone ever doubted whether our generation could meet the test or would pay the price, the courage of seven Americans answered that question last week. They were ready to explore new frontiers, and so are we. We're determined to take charge of our future and to leave for our children, as our parents did for us, a richer America, richer in wealth, in opportunity, and most of all in spirit. That's our vision, and we're prepared to fight for it. Sometimes you have to fight for what you really believe in. As a Marine Corps veteran, I believe America has to be strong enough to defend our basic values and our freedom. But money alone won't make us strong. It's time to focus on what we get for our money, not just on how much we spend. Strength requires a clear strategy, weapons that will actually work in combat, and troops trained to use them. Strength also requires a healthy economy, but we won't have one much longer if we don't have the will to balance our federal checkbook. What our government needs desperately is discipline. If defense spending has to be reduced, then let's reduce it. If domestic spending has to be cut, then let's cut it. If tax breaks have to be stopped, then let's stop them. It's going to take all of these steps, and all of us know it. These decisions aren't going to be easy or politically popular, but we've been making them in the states. where 34 of the 50 governors and two-thirds of the state legislatures are Democratic. The bottom line is this: America will never fulfill its destiny until it puts its own financial house in order. And the time to act is now. The stakes are high. America is in the economic fight of its life, and we're up against tough new competitors around the world. We've got to meet them head on. We can't afford to settle for second best in anything. We need to invest in excellence. Excellence in educating our children, excellence in training our workers, excellence in making our products, and yes, excellence in the way we run our government. And the road to excellence begins with opportunity. We proved that 3 months ago in Virginia, where through hard work and ability, the son of a truck driver, the grandson of a slave, and the daughter of a rural school teacher won election to the three highest offices in our state. That's the promise of America. Since Jefferson's time, there have been two conflicting views about what makes America prosperous and strong. Some believe that a handful of elites drive our economy, and that the rest of us should be satisfied with what trickles down. Democrats, like most Americans, believe that the key to America's success is giving everyone a chance to get ahead. Every time we've opened avenues of opportunity to more of our people, we've made our country stronger. Innovation and growth, opportunity and excellence, strength and discipline. That's what our party stands for. Our future and our children's future is worth fighting for. And a new generation of Democrats is ready to lead the way.
In South Dakota, where I live, we admire people who fight for what they believe in. They're part of our landscape. These folks had a lot in common. Great writers, great speakers, but even more, we remember them for what they did. Each one of them learned the hard way that you had to fight for everything worthwhile. That nothing important comes easy. And it hasn't been easy for a lot of people I know either. This is the farm of Richard and Bonnie McBrayer. They're good friends of mine, the McBrayers. Not unlike thousands of others in rural America right now. Four generations ago, the first McBrayers broke virgin land with their own hands. And in the last century, they've survived every catastrophe that both man and nature have encountered. They've been burned out by walls of flames, started by barons who would take their land, and frozen out by winters so cold it stopped all life, by wind and dust that actually buried the barn, and drought which stole the very life from their foundation herds. But you know what? They've survived all of this because they're fighters. They know how to work. Like Jefferson, himself a farmer, they're part of America that will not die. Well, now, chances are better than ever that powers greater than any seen before could push Richard and Bonnie off their land before the end of this year. And even though they've met every test that God and man have put before them, many policymakers are saying they're no longer needed. And as the corporate giants rip out the trees and destroy the heritage, well, it may be their land, but it won't be their home.
In the name of the Father, and the Son, and the Holy Spirit, amen. Bless us, O Lord, in these thy gifts which we are about to receive from the bounty to Christ our Lord, amen. Fathers.
Richard and Bonnie McBrayer haven't failed. The administration has. During the past decade, the McBrayers have been told to play with one set of rules, and the government has been playing with another. This country was going to feed the world. There was no end to the market out there. Farmers were to break up more ground and buy new equipment. The sky's the limit, they were told. But then, the government decided it was wrong, and policies changed. To finance the deficit, interest rates went sky high, and the overvalued dollar pushed American products right out of many foreign markets. And now, the administration is saying, tough luck. And they're taking the tools the McBrayers need to survive, and they're foreclosing on the homes where they live. It's a familiar story, not just on the farm, but to families in Detroit in Youngstown, in the Silicon Valley. Working Americans doing everything they should, trying to make it in a world that's changing. And President Reagan said precious little in his speech tonight to address their needs. And they wait for word. Well, we give them our word. We're not going to give up on the McBrayers or families like them, and they won't give up on themselves. Americans can do extraordinary things when the deck's stacked against them, and we're on their side in this fight. We won't count them out.
President Harry Truman liked to quote Jefferson, who said that there are extraordinary possibilities in ordinary people. This is a courtroom in Independence where Harry Truman once presided. At the time, no one imagined that he would become one of our great presidents. But his life is a lesson that reaches across the years. He believed in himself and in his neighbors. He was one of us. He knew how real people lived, and he knew what they could accomplish given half a chance, just as my own neighbors have done. I live on the other side of the state, in University City, a suburb of St. Louis. For a time, our town was in real trouble. Stores were closing, people were moving out. We realized that if we were going to keep our homes and our way of life, the buck stopped with us. We planted trees and built walkways and bike paths and did what we could to improve things. But we still couldn't get a single major grocery store to move in. So we built a farmer's market, and Audrey Matthews started selling food there in a stall. Today, she has a thriving food store. Paul and Suzanne Schumer started a bookstore. John Bordeaux opened his own bike shop. A record store and eating places began and expanded. The big institutions didn't solve our problem. We did, by believing in each other. Together, we're making this a wonderful place to live and grow up. It's still home for our parents and for our children. In a way, our country is like our local towns. None of us can prosper unless all of us advance together. We can't let ourselves be at the mercy of big institutions that often don't even know how their decisions affect our lives. We've learned that people can help themselves if they have the tools to work with and common sense to guide them. A farmer doesn't need help growing corn. He needs a price for his product. Small business doesn't need help taking inventory. It needs access to markets. And young workers have the drive to compete, but they need to learn and earn in jobs of the future. These are our challenges, and they require some tough choices. But Americans are ready to make those choices. The naysayers told Jefferson it was a waste of money to buy the Louisiana Territory, but without it, we wouldn't have Missouri or the Far West. And they said an ordinary man like Truman couldn't govern our country. But you know, whenever someone told Harry Truman that it can't be done, he answered, just watch.
Life, liberty, the pursuit of happiness. Thomas Jefferson wrote these words in my hometown of Philadelphia, where I've lived these words. My family came to America as slaves, but my parents and grandparents believed that the American dream could come true. They didn't have material possessions to lead me, but they gave me faith and taught me to work hard. My dad was a preacher and an educator. He never had a big paying job. When it came time for me to go to college, my family and my church both had to help me out. I became a Baptist minister, like my father and his father before him. I want every American to have a dream and the chance to fulfill it. But things are changing, and we all know it. Take the timber worker outside Spokane. He's willing to get up as early, to stay as late, to sweat as hard as his father did. But suddenly, the jobs have disappeared for him and for his kids. That's why the budget deficit matters, not because of numbers, but because of people. If our country can't control the budget, then our families will find that their own future is out of control. When young couples go to buy their first home, they find their own government competing with them at the bank for mortgage money. Our farmers and factory workers are losing out to foreign competitors because our goods abroad cost too much. And they cost too much because of our national debt. In just 5 years, the Reagan administration has doubled the national debt. Doubled the debt. We've gone from being the greatest creditor nation to being the greatest debtor nation on earth. We don't have to sell off America piece by piece to lower the deficit, not if we make the right choices. And as chairman of the House Budget Committee, I know we can. Last year, we lowered the president's deficit. We did it by looking at every single federal spending program, both domestic and in the Pentagon, and making cuts where they made sense. We didn't do it by taking education from our kids. We didn't do it by slashing science and research for our future growth. And we didn't do it by taking it from our elderly. We cared. We worked together. And we solved the problem. Let me give you an example from my own church. A few years ago, we found that a lot of our older folks couldn't find a place to live in the neighborhood near their own families. So we got together and we built homes for them. We did it with a loan which we're now repaying. It was a loan from the American people who decided through our government to make this kind of investment in our country. But some people, powerful people, tell us we can't do this anymore, that it's time to settle for less and lower our hopes and put aside our dreams. 35 years ago, my father had to go to the back door of a restaurant to get food for his hungry children waiting out in the car because of the color of his skin. Today, we have a society of greater opportunity and equality because we struggle to open more doors to every American. It's time to keep opening doors, to give something back to our country in return for what's been given to us, to create an America of more choices for all our people.
In Philadelphia, as we just saw, in Maine, where I come from, all across the country, Americans are still doing the right things. Yet, we sense the world changing around us. How will our sons and daughters build a career? What kinds of choices will they have? How can we make sure families getting started have jobs? Jobs that are going somewhere? We can't do it if we continue policies that neglect our families and our schools, our research and science. The percentage of our sons and daughters who graduate from high school now is lower than it was 15 years ago. One in every four American students drops out before graduation. Japan now produces twice as many engineers as we do, even though they have less than half our population. The future is knowledge, information, skill. This is no time to reduce our commitment to that future. The best social service agency is a family that's together. The best social program is a good job. But the policies of this administration are having the opposite effect. They're driving more families into hard times and apart, and they're causing American jobs to move overseas. We must invest now in our people, in human capital, to make America once more number one in education, in know-how, in science and research. Only then will we again outthink, outwork, and outproduce the world. The country of Thomas Edison and Orville Wright should be inventing the future, not copying others. The country that rebuilt Germany and Japan after World War II should not just surrender in the battle for foreign trade. It will be a bitter irony if we lose the trade war after winning the world war, but we are losing it. America's trade deficit is now close to $150 billion a year. That's the biggest trade deficit ever run up by any country at any time in the entire history of the world. And every $1 billion of that deficit means thousands of jobs lost. In every market, from cars to cameras, from Europe to South America, even in our own country, the competition is winning. Believe me, in the battle for trade, America is no longer. Republicancy is more like Pee-wee's Big Adventure. These trade and budget deficits mean we are living on borrowed money, too much of it from foreigners. Living on borrowed money means on borrowed time. The day of reckoning is not far off. We must respond now, before it's too late, by increasing American productivity, by competing aggressively in world markets, and by insisting that fair competition is a two-way street. Here at home, we earn our share of the future, and all of us must play by the same rules. even the most powerful among us. That's not happening now. In just 4 years, 50 of the biggest corporations made $57 billion in profits, and they didn't pay 1 cent in federal income tax. In 1983, over 3,000 people had incomes of more than $1 million and paid virtually no income taxes. When you file your return this year, think about that. Thousands of wealthy Americans will file theirs without paying taxes. If that makes you mad, it should, because it's wrong, it must be changed, and we're going to change it. Democrats first proposed tax reform. Democrats in the House passed tax reform. For 3 years, the administration was against it. We welcome the president's support now, and we hope that he can convince enough Republicans to join us to see that every American pays a fair share of taxes, and that working Americans get to keep more of the money they earn. On the budget, we must finally make real choices. We can no longer rely on rhetoric which refuses to face the real world, which pretends that we can have unlimited military spending and unrestrained tax breaks and a balanced budget all at the same time. That hasn't happened. It won't happen. It can't happen. And when he says it can, as he often has, the president is wrong. And the American people know he's wrong. But the president is surely right when he says that a nuclear war can never be won and must never be fought. We welcome the summit meetings. We look forward to a real summit agreement, one that makes us safer, one that achieves deep and verifiable reductions of nuclear weapons on both sides. For Americans, for people everywhere, nothing is more important. Without an agreement, we will face an even more dangerous world with new kinds of nuclear weapons and with nuclear weapons in new hands. We must limit the export of the nuclear technology that could give this most awesome power to the most dangerous madmen on Earth. Tonight, we've set forth some of our values, our sense of direction for America. We are Democrats. For 200 years, the party of the people, the party of the future. As our president, John Kennedy, said, the debates of the past took place in a different world with different needs and different tasks. It is our responsibility today to live in our own world, to meet the authentic problems of our time, to generate a vision and an energy which will demonstrate anew to the world the superior vitality of a free society.
Bless us, O Lord, in these thy gifts which we are about to receive from thy bounty through Christ our Lord. Amen. Father, Son, Holy Spirit. Amen.
What you have just seen is the Democrats' response to President Reagan's State of the Union message tonight. This Democratic response, it was paid for, the production of it, by the Democrats themselves. Now, while the president stressed the importance of the American family and the American dream, as both parties are doing in this congressional election year, the Democrats, in their response, warned that, as they see it, President Reagan's economic policies, his actual policies, will undermine American family stability and independence. Maine's Senator George Mitchell moderated the Democrats' response, and he said that President Reagan's policies actually are driving more families into hard times and apart, and that they're causing American jobs to move overseas. Senator Mitchell said that Reagan administration trade policies are less like Rocky or Rambo than like Pee-wee's Great Adventure. The senator said, and I quote, "We can no longer rely on rhetoric which refuses to face the real world, which presents and pretends that we can have unlimited military spending and unrestrained tax breaks and a balanced budget all at the same time," unquote. Former Governor Charles Robb of Virginia said that whether it's defense spending, domestic spending, or tax breaks, quote, "what the government desperately needs is discipline." That was the Democrats' response, in brief and in summary. Now, in a moment, we'll take a quick, close look at the President's State of the Union message and the Democratic reply to it through the eyes, ears, and minds of our CBS News White House and Capitol Hill correspondents. So stay right with us. our usual practice, joining me now for a quick, close look at the State of the Union messages, or when I say the President's State of the Union message and the Democrats' response, our CBS News White House correspondent Bill Plant and our Capitol Hill correspondent Phil Jones. Bill Plant, the President, among other things, wanted to set up the situation as best he could for the detailed release of the budget tomorrow. What is the most important thing in that budget message?
Dan, the budget message is going to be hard and bitter, calling for a lot of cuts in programs that affect middle-class people. It's going to be very difficult to pass. Mr. Reagan's priorities are the same as they have been for 5 years, to cut the level of spending permanently in this country. So tonight, he teed up. He gave it his best shot. The act is going to be very, very tough to follow.
Phil Jones on Capitol Hill, the Democrats seem to be arguing about who can best take care of the future. Now, they don't like what the president has outlined, but what specifically is the most important thing they're proposing as an alternative?
Well, I think what they're proposing as an alternative is to sit back and watch the Republicans. They think that the Republicans are going to be bickering between the White House and up here. And many Republicans fear the same thing. There are differences in priorities between the Republican at the White House and the Republicans up here. On tax reform, the president thinks that they should move before they resolve the budget. He wants to spend more money on defense than many Republicans do up here. And he wants most of the deficit handled through heavy cuts in domestic spending and no tax increase. Republicans don't agree with this. Many of them don't. Interestingly enough, the first friendly shot has already been fired tonight from Senator Dole, who is the Senate Majority Leader, who issued a statement even before the president was finished, saying the administration agenda is jam-packed with thorny issues. It's going to take all the president's power to work with Congress. Translated, that means Republicans here think the president's been sitting on the sidelines too long.
Thank you very much, Bill Plant and Phil Jones. And so, as we try to do each year, the President's State of the Union address, the Democrats' response, and the CBS News commentary and analysis. That does it. Dan Rather for CBS News. Thank you. Good night.